From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we speak with local ophthalmologist Dr. Barbara Borosko, a leading expert in glaucoma. She is the co-founder and medical director of My Eyes, a local company that helps glaucoma patients with new technology. Then we speak with author and dog intelligence researcher Jennifer Holland. Her new book, Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence, is a cutting-edge science narrative and outlines Holland's quest to learn the true meaning of dog intelligence. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest, Dr. Barbara Borosko, is a local resident and a serial entrepreneur for biotech startups. Her research is in new glaucoma therapeutics.
She is also an ophthalmologist at the University of Utah Redstone Clinic and the Moran Eye Center.
She's the medical director for a startup which she co-founded. It's called My Eyes. It helps people learn how to improve treatment of their glaucoma through some advanced technology. Barbara is also the founder of the Joseph James Morelli Foundation, which helps young people with dyslexia. Barbara, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn and Katie, and so cool to be back here again.
It's really great to have you, and it's always fun to hear what you're doing because you're always doing something pretty cutting edge when it comes to the use of technology to help your ophthalmology patients. The My Eyes is no exception to that. Can you talk a little bit first about glaucoma? You know, we know it's an age-related disease, I guess you call it, that can eventually lead to blindness, but talk about the numbers in our country.
So glaucoma is actually a fairly common pathology, and we refer to it as a chronic, slowly progressive optic neuropathy. So if you think about other neuropathies, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, they slowly occur over time, and glaucoma is very similar. The one thing that's unique about glaucoma is a lot of people will not even know they have it. We refer to it as the silent thief of sight, because patients can slowly lose vision and sight over time due to pressure in the eye. And the biggest risk factor and the only modifiable risk factor for treating glaucoma is actually pressure. And we call it intraocular pressure or IOP.
Okay, so it's that direct pressure to the eye that destroys the optic nerve. And what My Eyes has done, and it's very interesting, the importance, I did not know this, of being able to monitor that pressure. And you monitor it through something called tonometry. Did I get the correct pronunciation of it?
Yes.
Tonometry.
Yes.
And there are a couple of different types of tonometry, but what My Eyes is doing is helping people monitor that pressure at home. Can you explain what tonometry is?
So if you go into a doctor's office for an eye exam, a lot of people will say, oh, you know, I had this little puff of air in my eye, or I received, you know, a drop of this yellow liquid and then a blue light and something touched my eye. Those are all various types of tonometry. What we've been learning, and this was really the reason for the inception of My Eyes, is that IOP fluctuates. We've known that IOP fluctuates and varies just like blood pressure does, just like glucose does. Mm-hmm. It varies over the course of a day. It varies over the course of weeks, months, and it's not static. We've done a really good job as a medical community in getting glucose, continuous glucose monitors and blood pressure monitors into the homes of patients. And why? Because we know that if you have tighter control of that glucose, you can actually improve outcomes and slow down the disease process. Now with glaucoma, we're realizing that we really are treating, we could be treating the disease better. We could be monitoring patients better because, in fact, pressure varies. We've been finding that it spikes early in the morning. In some patients who come to my office and appear to have, you know, what's called a normal pressure, it actually could be much higher in the morning, with exercise. Pressure also varies with medication. Steroids can increase pressure in the eye. And as we get older, pressure will change. So why are we only checking a pressure that has direct correlations to vision loss and a disease once, twice, three, four times a year? We should be measuring it several times a day to really understand how the pressure is fluctuating in that individual patient. And again, just I go back to, you know, diabetes, glucose, high blood pressure, even sleep apnea, right? We've got monitors in the home to monitor these chronic diseases, and glaucoma is no different. It's a chronic disease with a variable that fluctuates that we can do much better in monitoring at home and get a better complete picture.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Dr. Barbara Wierosko. She is medical director and co-founder of My Eyes. It's an organization looking to preserve sight through home tonometry. Well, you talk about monitoring blood pressure and glucose, and those diseases, I guess, have they're preventable. Exercise, diet, et cetera. Is glaucoma preventable?
That's a great question, Katie. So what we've seen with the home tonometer is if I have a patient, so when you say preventable, how do you diagnose it? It's a conglomerate of different, basically, signs or tests. So I always say that it's the totality of the information. So if your genetic predisposition to glaucoma, that would be a risk factor. If you come in and see me as a glaucoma specialist and I do several tests, I will look at those tests in as a totality of the data. So each test does not stand alone. So I could say to you, yes, you are at risk, but we don't see any damage yet. But if I then give you a home tonometer and find that your pressure is actually spiking quite high, I may actually discuss with you starting therapy sooner or doing something sooner rather than waiting for damage. So think of it as, you know, this is kind of a different analogy, but if somebody told you you're likely to have a heart attack, you would want to intervene earlier. And glaucoma is sort of the same, right? We don't know somebody has it until damage appears. But if we know that they've got really high pressures, you know, outside of the office, that could be an early indication that they will develop damage several years down the road. And we can actually, in a way, prevent the damage, we hope. And this is really where it's cutting edge. We've never had this ability to do this before, but it has enabled me to be more proactive in treating patients because of this additional information.
That's amazing, because my mother just had glaucoma surgery and she's 83. And so who knows how long she's had it. Her vision is so much better now, which is great that she can actually see better. But let's say someone my age in their mid-50s, you start to notice the symptoms, if you will. Mm-hmm. What are the treatments pre-surgery that people can be involved with?
So medication is one. Generally, we start to use, we start with topical eye drops. The other intervention that's actually becoming more widely recommended is something called SLT, or selective laser trabeculoplasty. And it's a 5 to 10 minute laser that's done in the office. And what it does is it treats the inside of the eye or the drain. So although the damage is to the back of the eye, the system, so to speak, that's faulty in the eye is the drain. So fluid is made inside the eye, aqueous, and it leaves the eye through this drain or this angle. We refer to it as open angle glaucoma, narrow angle glaucoma. So if you treat this drain with a very low power cold laser, you can actually improve the outflow and lower the pressure. So think of it as, you know, hair in your drain in the sink, and this cold laser is opening the drain. And what's nice is you can have it repeated. There's a really interesting study that got published a few years ago that came out of the UK, and they found that in patients who were treated either with laser, SLT, or eye drops, even though the pressures were the same, those patients who received the laser actually had less progression in visual field loss. So what we're thinking now is that the SLT does a better job in reducing those pressure fluctuations. It reduces those spikes, which again, we're missing with in-office testing. So we've been doing a lot of work at Moran where we're actually treating patients with the laser and then giving them the eye care home before and after the laser to look at those pressure spikes. And in fact, yes, the laser works really well to lower those pressure spikes. And I think, Katie, to your point is, you know, again, when you say, what else can you do? The other thing we don't really know, and hopefully we'll learn more with this technology, is we don't know when those pressure spikes are starting that actually lead to damage. Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? And a lot of it depends upon the genetics of the patient. But we've got patients, you know, in their 40s and 50s that are having pressure spikes that need to be treated. And what's really nice, too, is the eye care home. It enables patients to live 4 to 5 hours away from me, and I can send them the device, and they don't need to drive in to see me just for a 5-minute pressure check. And it's really important that we're measuring these pressures not just over 24 hours, but generally over a week to 2 weeks as well, and before and after interventions, right? Because how do you know if your interventions are actually working? But if you have this technology, you can now actually have that patient, you know, measure it over a week, 2 weeks, then they can come back and they can use the device again in 2 or 3 months to see that the surgery or the intervention is actually still working.
Okay, so this home tonometry device then, it feeds the information into the Moran Eye Center?
Into a cloud-based system.
Okay, and so that's how it can be monitored over a week. But the actual device, what is the patient doing? Because I know they have the puff tonometry, right? And then there's another type that involves a probe. But how does this device actually work? How can you administer it to yourself?
So it's based on what's called a rebound technology. So it's a handheld, lightweight device. The patient, you don't need any anesthesia, you don't need any eye drops. And this little probe is at the center of the device, and it's within like milliseconds, it will touch the cornea, and based on the rebound, it then determines the pressure. And there's been the FDA and European regulatory agencies have a set of requirements that have to be done in order to get a device cleared. We call devices get cleared, drugs get approved. And in order for a device to be cleared, it has to show that it's reproducible, it's validated, it can pick up the correct numbers, right? You want to be able to trust it. So this particular device has gone through numerous clinical studies, and it's easy to use, it's reliable, and it's patient-friendly. You know, I've had patients that are young use it, and I've had patients that are over 100 figure out how to use it. So it's a pretty cool little invention. It's the first one that's actually been cleared for home use. And then obviously, like anything, wow, there's a value here. So there's other companies that are looking to come out with other, you know, home monitoring devices. But currently, the iCare Home 2 is the only one that's on the market for patients. And the reason we started My Eyes was actually to get the device into the hands of patients.
Right. Well, the story of the founding of My Eyes is pretty interesting because one of your co-founders is actually a glaucoma patient. He got involved because he realized that this would really help him. And I think you're all local residents, right? All the founders?
Yes. And I always say that it was founded by a doctor, a patient, and a technician. And we were all just very passionate about saving vision and trying to better understand this pathology and this device, or sorry, this pathology. And the way it happened was the iCare Home initially wasn't accessible to patients. So patients couldn't buy it easily. My co-founder tried to get access to it and was able to purchase it, but not easily. And what he said to me when he came into the office, we found out that indeed his pressures weren't controlled and they were spiking. And it completely changed the trajectory of his care. And he said, Barb, there's got to be other patients like me that would benefit from this. And I started thinking about it and I thought, well, maybe patients don't necessarily need to buy the device, which could be several thousands of dollars. Maybe they just need to rent it. Maybe they just need to use it for a short time period before and after treatment, you know, a few months out of the year, just to see what their pressure is doing to better inform the care. So I think, you know, it's interesting because we started the company really to see if there was an unmet need. And not only has it been helping patients, but it's also changed the way so many of my colleagues now think about glaucoma. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many papers coming out now. And we're learning which therapies actually work. We're understanding variability between patients. It really, you know, we call it glaucoma, but I always say it's a wastebasket. There's a lot of difference, you know, between patients, between the types of glaucoma. And I think what the eye care home too, or home tonometry has done is I have a few patients now through my eyes where they live in Alaska and they would have to fly to Washington State for a pressure check every few months. So this has again changed and freed them up. The other thing that I've found too is that amongst some of my own patients who have purchased the device, it's improved the compliance and adherence because now you see that a medication's actually working. You know, you've got proof that if you're using an eye drop and you forget it and suddenly your pressure goes up, you know, you've got documentation and you see that, yes, what I'm doing is actually working. Because as I said before in the beginning, glaucoma is a silent disease. So it's when you don't have symptoms, it's hard, you know, like all of us, right? You're on a chronic medication and you're saying, well, is it really doing anything? Because I don't have any symptoms. But now we have evidence.
Well, if you don't have symptoms and, you know, you're like most of us and we get into the eye doctor once every couple of years, unfortunately, is this at-home testing something that we could just say, I just want to start? Or do you have to actually prescribe the at-home testing?
Good question, Katie. So yes, it is a prescription. You have to be prescribed it by a doctor. So it's complementary to an in-office test. So think of it as, you know, again, you go into a medical doctor's office and they say, oh, you know, your sugar seems a little bit high. Well, let's, you know, monitor your glucose levels for like a month or a week. It's that type of testing. It's to complement what we would normally do in the office, but then add more information.
Yeah. Well, you know, you hear about people that live at elevation, especially like in the Himalayas and the cataracts. Is our high elevation living here in Park City a risk factor for glaucoma as well?
We don't think so. None of the studies have shown that altitude at where we live actually impacts glaucoma. There is some thought, well, there is the association between sleep apnea and glaucoma. And I always wonder, again, do we have a higher likelihood of patients having sleep apnea because we're at higher elevations, you know, here in Utah, but that also has never really been studied.
Yeah. So going back to the intraocular pressure, the eye pressure, from what you've been saying, it's my understanding that you don't feel an increased pressure. It's not something that we can feel. And therefore, at the onset of glaucoma, for example, we don't have any symptoms that we feel. It might just be our sight is affected. And as people age, you know, a lot of our sight is kind of you know, going down the drain anyway, right? So how do you know? How do you know the difference? Is it just from that visit to your doctor?
Yes. So when I talk about the totality of the information or the totality of the data, pressure is just one piece. But if you have a family history, if you're on, let's say, you know, steroids, that can raise your pressure. If your nerve looks suspicious, so we'll do other testing in the office. We'll do what's called a visual field, which is a test for the function of the optic nerve. And then we'll do something called an OCT, which is a test for the structure of the optic nerve. So again, it's sort of the three pieces together. If the pressure's high, if your visual field, which is the measure of your peripheral vision, is showing changes, and then the nerve looks damaged and it correlates with the visual field, we may say it looks like you have early glaucoma. And then the next piece to figure out is what is your pressure doing? And that's where the home tonometry and understanding those pressure spikes is so critical, because you want to lower from the highest number. So if you're in the office and your pressure is 20, I may say, oh, let's get your pressure down to 16. Drops would work. But if we find that your pressure early in the morning between the hours of 5 and 6, it's spiking to 30, but yet in the office, you're 20, that's a very different treatment plan with that information. So that's where the eye care tonometry or the home tonometry really, really adds value, is understanding just what that fluctuation is and just how high those pressure spikes are.
I see. Yeah. So if your pressure spike is much higher, you might be recommending the laser treatment or something like that. So it's interesting. I was just talking to my dad this morning, and he has pressure in one eye and he takes medication for it. So at what point, I mean, you know, we have a little high blood pressure and you go and, you know, you order a blood pressure cuff on Amazon, and, you know, I have one at home just for kicks, just to know, right? Curiosity. But, you know, what kind of price are we talking about? And at what point would you want to have a home tonometry device?
So most of our patients right now, so we've now with my eyes, we've had in 2 years, thousands of patients rent or buy the device. And it depends upon location, depends upon finances. I am working with the manufacturer to try to get what's called a HCPCS code. So it'll eventually get hopefully reimbursed by insurance, but right now it doesn't get reimbursed. Although we have had some patients get it paid for through their secondary insurance companies. So either the insurance will pay for the rental, which is $250 for a week, or they'll pay for the device, which is $3,000. And it really depends upon, you know, the severity of the disease for that individual. You know, I've had patients who have had a lot of different surgeries in their eyes, and they feel naked without owning the device. You know, and it's fascinating, because I had a patient the other day where we are managing his eye drops after the surgery based on his pressure. And he can give me that information real time, so I can say, okay, cut back on this eye drop, or add this, or go up on that. I've managed patients in Arizona after surgery, and all they have to do is tell me, okay, I just took my pressures today, and this is what my pressures are doing. And I'll be like, okay, that sounds good. You know, yes, when you're back up here in Park City in a month, you know, make an appointment, but right now things are good. And then other patients I've had, which is, again, we're learning so much about glaucoma and risk factors. I've had patients who have high pressures every time they come into the office, and the home tonometry has actually shown that they don't have large amounts of fluctuation. The fluctuation is very minimal, so they don't have any damage. So is it really the number, Or is it the degree of fluctuation? That's another piece that we're starting to try to figure out and learn. Mm-hmm. And as I always say, my patients are teaching me.
We're speaking with Dr. Barbara Worosko. She is a local resident and a serial entrepreneur and is a co-founder of My Eyes. And Barbara, because I have spoken to you so many times about the Joseph James Morelli Foundation, it's completely a tangent and not what we've been talking about, but I just love to get a really quick update on how the foundation's going. It seems to help so many young people with dyslexia.
Thanks, Lynn. Thank you. So yes, so the Joseph James Morelli Legacy Foundation is the nonprofit that our family started when our son Joseph was killed 10 years ago. It's going to be 10 years this year. And we are now a nationally recognized nonprofit. We have given away over $500,000 to kids around the country. And 175 students or scholars have received our support. We not only offer tuition resources, financial support, but now we've added mentoring. So all of our incoming first-year students in college actually are eligible once they go through our application process. If we're selected, they are eligible not for not only the financial support, but also the mentoring piece. So it's a peer-to-peer mentoring program, which has kept our students in school. And as I always say, our kids can be in college, they can be in universities, they can be in trade schools. They have to be in a STEM field. They have to have dyslexia. And this year we are having a guest speaker, David Flink, and our event is going to be on August the 17th. So that's a Saturday at the Shed up in Promontory at 5 o'clock. And it's always a free event for everybody in Park City and Utah, whoever wants to come and learn more.
Wonderful. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. It's always so great to hear what you're doing out there in the medical world.
Thank you. And if anybody wants to learn more, the website is myeyes.net. And just go online and everything's on the website, all the information and papers, articles, videos. And then, of course, people can reach out to me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, we've all seen on Instagram those unimaginable feats of dog behavior, like, you know, the dog who does partner yoga or dances or surfs. And we wonder if our own dogs could do that if we were smart enough to teach them. Our next guest is best-selling author Jennifer Holland. She was on a quest to unlock the scientific secrets of dog cognition. How do we gauge canine intelligence? Jennifer joins us today to talk about her new book. It's chock full of scientific research on how our dogs really are probably far smarter than we think. It's called Dog Smart: Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. Jennifer, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, anytime we can talk about our dogs in a scientific milieu, we love to do it because we're a science show, but it's really fun to talk about the science behind those little creatures that we love so much. How did you get interested in this topic? It's not your first book on dogs. And what drives you?
Well, I think my love of dogs is sort of the beginning of it all, as for most of us, interested in how dogs think and learn because I'm around them so much. I have my own. I struggle to get them to do what I want. And I was curious, you know, if your dog isn't learning the way you want them to, does that mean you have a dumb dog? And I think, you know, we often say that, oh, my dumb dog doesn't do X, Y. What I've learned is that sometimes those are the smartest dogs, really, because they're telling us that we're not doing a very good job, perhaps, in how we're teaching them. It's all about giving them the right incentives. But yeah, the book came about as just I wanted to think about dog cognition maybe in a little bit of a new way and think about what does it mean to be intelligent if you are a non-human? What does it mean in a dog's world to be intelligent? And that led me into all kinds of, down a lot of rabbit holes, I should say.
You know, one of the things is we look at other creatures' intelligence through our own perspective, not necessarily through theirs. And so we might not recognize a superpower like, you know, olfaction, for example, how our dogs smell and that it's so intelligent. And with humans, we've started to look at multiple intelligences like emotional intelligence, things that, you know, maybe can't be measured. But when we talk about dog intelligence, what are you looking at specifically in this book?
As you say, something like olfaction for a dog, that's one of the main tools that they use to navigate the world. And we don't really think about what must that be like and how much does that impact everything that they do. And so olfactory intelligence is a big part of the book. I really get into the sniffer dog world, these detection dogs that do remarkable things. You know, dogs can be trained to sniff out pretty much anything if you train them properly. And that's incredible, really, to think about. But I also do look at emotional intelligence. I look at these comfort dogs that we use to help people who are going through a trauma. I look at social intelligence and kind of specifically communicative intelligence, communication, body language. The dog's body language is so robust and interesting and detailed, and we're not always that great at reading, I think, what our dogs are trying to tell us, but they are incredibly good at reading each other, at reading us. They just have skills that I think are beyond anything that we really understand. And more broadly, I should say, adaptive intelligence is kind of the broader theme. Just the idea that intelligence means making the decisions that help you to thrive, solving the problems you need to solve. And so dogs are very, very good at that. And that's why they've been so successful around the world.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Jennifer Holland. She is talking about her new book, Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. Well, Jennifer, years ago, I was reading a book and he talked about the idea of Umwelt, which is an animal's experience. And I'd never really thought about that. And the example he gave was, you're standing here as a human, you're up, you know, 5 foot, whatever, looking at the world with your eyes and your ears. And the dog is down below, maybe a foot tall if you're lucky. And it's experiencing things so much different. And that really was such an incredible thing to think about, because all of a sudden you started to understand that every other species, every other creature has a different experience. As compared to, before we really get into the discussion of intelligence, how does a dog experience the world differently than a human?
Well, I think first and foremost is that nose being the primary tool. So everything that a dog is investigating is going to go through the nose first, and that's probably going to give them the most information. Dogs' vision is very good, in some ways better than ours, and in some ways not as good, depending on the circumstances. They see things in dim light a little better than we do. They're going to see motion sort of off in the peripheral, things that make sense in a dog's world, things that they, you know, they, if their ancestors were chasing, you know, small mammals, they need to be able to hunt in the evening and see that kind of whisker movement on a mouse, something like that. And, you know, sight is very good. Hearing is quite good. We know our dogs kind of sense maybe the car coming before we get to the driveway, that kind of thing. So they hear in a different range than we do.
The treat bag.
Yeah, they know the crinkle of the bag. And they also sort of seem to know what we're thinking sometimes, you know, sort of that, how does my dog know that I'm thinking about taking him for a walk? You know, I did something and he's aware of it. I'm not even aware of that change in my behavior that seems to have clued him in. But yeah, that world of the smell universe, as some people call it, just all of that information that they need to figure out what's around them and how to make good decisions and how to behave. And we forget that. We really do. We're all about the visual. We're like, get the red ball, you know, and everything is about sight. But really, the dogs are doing something else first.
Well, from an evolutionary standpoint, can they trace back any sort of evolution, if you will, of a dog's olfactory capabilities? Or have they always been good smellers?
Yes, I think because you go back and we're talking about a wolf-like ancestor. So we're talking about an animal that's going to be a hunter and that's going to have a social group, you know, probably much like wolves do. And so olfaction being such an important part of how they interact with one another and how they interact with their environment. So I would say the nose has been very, very good for that kind of animal from, you know, many thousands of years ago. I think we have had a huge impact on dogs and they on us, I will say, which we don't tend to think about as much. But yeah, I would say the nose has been the thing for a very long time.
Well, speaking of the nose and a dog's olfactory intelligence, or to what degree have we sort of dumbed them down as we have domesticated them, especially with something like olfaction? Like my dog doesn't need that skill necessarily because he's going to get fed to, you know, life is going to be easy whether or not he can smell or not.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a great question. And I do think we tend to not think so much about the things we've taken away from dogs by making them fit into our world. And it's a good life. It's not that, you know, that it's a horrible thing that our dogs live with us and maybe sleep on the bed and have an easy time of it, certainly easier than what the street dogs are experiencing, for example. But it is kind of a shame that they maybe don't get to use that sense as much as they would like. We're always in a hurry, you know, stop sniffing that, let's go, get your nose away from that nasty pile of whatever on the road. And actually in the book, I do talk a little bit about what can we give back to them to let them be, you know, give them back some of their dogness. Can we sort of allow them to have access to these skills that these, you know, this natural sort of capabilities, which is really good for their brains. I mean, that's where all the processing takes place. And so if you want your dog to be smart, you want to give them access to all the tools that they have.
And on the flip side of what we've taken away from dogs, there are certainly intelligences that we have helped enhance. For example, the manipulation intelligence, shall we call it? It's part of emotional intelligence, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? I mean, my dog can look at me and I know what he's saying to me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There, you know, there's definitely been some co-evolution there of, you know, traits that have been enhanced in dogs because of how we respond to them. And even physiological traits, you know, there's studies showing that, you know, the muscles in the face of dogs have changed over time because we respond to that look, you know, that sort of puppy dog look with the raised eyebrow and the flip of the head and things. And dogs do more and more of that because we have selectively bred for those kinds of traits that we enjoy. But they have learned to read us in ways that we can't even really understand, just again, because of that relationship over time and them making choices and making decisions that that are positive for them. And that means tolerating us, tolerating our primate ways. And yeah, that effect we've had on them has been huge.
Well, you talk about, you know, our primate ways, and you were talking about Odin, the dog that you helped rehabilitate, if you will. And you never really think about it. We are two very different species. And as primates, we approach a dog with our hands and probably way too much of our primateness with them. What is the difference between our primateness and their canineness that really can negatively affect our relationships with dogs?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, think about it. I know with me, my tendency is I want to hug this thing. You know, if I meet a dog, I want to get right up in their face. I want to pet them. I want to be, you know, physically on these animals. And if you think about wolves, for example, you know, they don't hug each other. Our dogs don't hug each other. Some of them don't really want to have that immediate eye contact. Some of them do. Of course, you have your average golden retriever is probably going to look you in the eye and make you swoon. But I have dogs that are a little more wary of people and they turn their head. You know, I actually see it in them when I'm trying to give them love in my way. Sometimes they're just not in the mood for that. And you have to be careful with dogs you don't know, especially they may not want you to reach over and pet. That can be, you know, sort of a sign of aggression, that reaching over their head, or obviously the hugging is something they tolerate. Some of them have learned to love it, but it's not natural for them.
Well, let's talk about what quote unquote intelligence means as well, because I think for a lot of us humans, we think intelligence means, oh, well, adding 2 + 2 = 4, or learning, you know, drive a car. But with dogs, is it an innate sense of what to do next or how to respond? How do you define human intelligence versus canine intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, I think really you can define them the same in a way if you step back and think about, you know, what does it mean to thrive as that species, whatever it is? How do you make the right decisions? How do you adapt to a situation and still, you know, get through in that situation? You know, dogs are masters of adaptation. They're probably, you know, they're one of the most successful mammals out there. I would say there are others, you know, bed bugs and rats and things like that. Bed bugs not being a mammal, of course, but, you know, I think that success shows that they are intelligent because they have mastered so many niches, whether it's living with humans in different contexts or living at the edge of human environments and taking advantage of the trash and taking advantage of the kinder people who do, you know, toss them a biscuit or leftovers. They really do make interesting choices and decisions that benefit them. And I think that's part of that intelligence. And then again, using their natural tools, whether it's the nose and other things that apply to that success is what I'm trying to say. I consider all of that part of their intelligence, you know, not just one thing. They can certainly learn to count. They can learn to do some of the things that seem more like intelligence in the way we think about it. But I tend to bring in a lot of these other aspects to the idea of intelligence.
We're speaking with Jennifer Holland about her new book called Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. So Jennifer, how do we go about measuring or gauging canine intelligence? You talk about like the equivalent of a doggy MRI. What is the science here?
Well, it's expanded a lot in recent years, which is really great, I think, for two reasons. One being there's more tools that we can use. For example, as you mentioned, MRI. So they have been able to train dogs to lie perfectly still and to be in an MRI long enough to get the brain scan, to expose them to different things and watch, you know, live what's happening in the brain. Where is that, you know, electrical activity happening? And what does that tell us about what they're thinking and what they like and what they don't like? So we're able to see inside a little better than we used to because of the tools at our disposal. And also I think it's expanded because people are becoming more accepting of this idea that there's a lot going on. This isn't just a instinct-driven creature out there that doesn't have thoughts and feelings and you know, doesn't think things through. I think we don't give them enough credit for that. And I'm really excited to see how much this field is expanding and people are really opening up to the idea that not just dogs, but all other, you know, other creatures have these amazing inner lives.
So in the book, you talk about a lot of different dogs who, you know, individuals who you studied and things that you learned in the research for this book. Tell us about one of the dogs that was found to have so much intelligence and what you found that really surprised you.
Yeah, gosh, there were many. I was very fortunate. Despite the pandemic, I was able to do a lot of field work and really get out there. I sought out working dogs because those would be the dogs that have the most opportunity, I think, to be to use all of their intelligence in different ways. And that included being with a couple of people who work with dogs that do conservation work. And we're talking about sniffer work, detection work. So for example, a dog named Jasper who can sniff out endangered species scat, you know, has been trained to find certain species of salamander, you know, a certain species, not just salamanders in general, but something very particular. He also can find toxins in the grout on a building window. You know, there's stuff that he's trained on to help determine if there's anything toxic or dangerous in some of these older buildings out in Washington. So that was remarkable to see a dog that is trained to do so many specific things like that, not just say they can generalize, but they can also really zoom in on something really particular. And probably the most fun one of those is a dog named Eba that's trained to find whale scat, so whale poop that's floating on the ocean surface. They go out in a boat, and the dog, just in her movements and her response, she helps the pilot of the boat find its, you know, find their way to where there is a pile floating. And the scientists are able to take samples, and they're trying to establish, you know, information about a population of whales. This is also out in Washington State area. But just incredible that the dog can zero in on this thing, that it knows how to lead them to it. Just, you know, kind of some crazy stuff that you don't envision dogs doing. But I just loved observing that. It was a lot of fun.
Another thing you talk about that dogs can do is the idea to pick up or to help detect an oncoming seizure. And we talk so much about scent, their ability to pick up COVID-19 and other diseases. But in the book, you talk about how they're picking up possibly on electromagnetic signals from our own bodies. All right, that is fascinating. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. I think, you know, this is one of the things. I think this is still a little bit uncertain, but they're trying to figure out what is it that dogs respond to when they've had many anecdotal cases of this, and now dogs are trained also to respond before a seizure happens in their owner. And they believe, you know, there's definitely a scent change that would be involved. There may be some behavioral changes as well that the dog is picking up on that again might not be that obvious to us. But that is definitely a consideration, that they may be able to sense, you know, just like a dog senses a storm coming. I know mine freaks out, you know, an hour before anything even happens. And so they may be picking up on signals like that again, we don't really even understand how that works, but they seem to be doing it.
I know they're really good at picking up on sadness, because I'm sure we've all laid on our dogs and cried when something sad is happening, and they know it. Yeah. Well, you also say that so often we expect our dogs to learn our language and how to interact as a primate, if you will. But how often are we actually learning their language? And what can we do to better learn their language?
Yeah, and it's interesting, because the idea of language is even controversial. Maybe that's not surprising, but there are people who say you can't really call it language in another animal. It's not, you know, and they kind of pick apart the term. What does that really mean? But I think, you know, dogs have a very intricate and powerful communication system, whatever you want to call it. And it includes their body language, it includes growls, it includes the way their tail is wagging, you know, the way the hair is on the back, all those things. I think we know it when we see it, but we're not very good at assessing it and reading it. And but if you go to, for example, a dog park and you watch, dogs figure it out. You know, they communicate with each other for the most part. I mean, it's not that it never goes awry, but if you watch them interact, you really do see how they are talking to each other. And if we understood that a little bit better, I think we could be better at avoiding bad situations with dogs. A dog bite, for example, with a dog that clearly, if you were able to back up and see it, you know, before it happens, you would probably see that there are signals there. The dog's, you know, body language, the way the tail is, the noises they're making, they do tell us what they're feeling and thinking. They're not hiding that. But we do fail to understand that, I think, fairly well. And I definitely advocate for being more in tune with that language and not expecting them to give that up in exchange for our way of communicating, which doesn't always work for them.
And yet it's so interesting to realize how much of our language dogs can understand. And, yes, you know, this brings me kind of to my next question about certain dogs with certain intelligences. Or I've read that border collies, for example, can have a vocabulary, or it's not having a vocabulary, right? It's being able to understand, you know, over 100 words. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about border collies, because we have the national, or I don't know if it's national, but we have a really significant sheepdog championship here. Mm-hmm. And when you go, the number one thing that hits home for me is, oh, I have done a huge disservice to my poor dog for not training him more and making him work because he would love it so much. You see those sheepdogs. So let's talk about the herder type dogs and their
Yeah, they are incredible to watch. They are super smart, no doubt about it, probably in many of the different ways that I talk about in the book. You know, people ask, well, are they smarter? It's like, well, in some ways, you know, they definitely are so in tune with us. They love to work. They want to get it right. There's this enthusiasm, I think, that has been bred into them, you know, for a very long time. And I think that they definitely lean toward that incredible bond with us and communication with us that not all dogs have. And with the other animals, for example, if you watch a sheepdog and you watch the herding process, this communication, not just with the shepherd or shepherdess, but with the sheep and this paying attention and all of that just intense focus on everything that's happening and the response to it. They are remarkable, those types of dogs. There's no doubt. I would say that they do have the kinds of intelligence that jump out at us. You definitely see that in those kinds of breeds.
Yeah. So if we were to talk to dog experts and you, what you've learned about dog intelligence, how can we be better dog parents?
Yeah, I think letting them, you know, thinking about what it means to be a dog and what would their life look like? Let's say they were on the streets. You know, what does it mean to be a dog? Since the vast majority of dogs don't live in households, they're actually the street dogs, the village dogs. And those dogs, you know, life is a lot harder for those animals, but they also have a certain amount of freedom to, you know, sniff and roll and play and fight and just, you know, mate and be dogs uninterrupted, as I say in the book. And while we're not going to just let our dogs run rampant and, you know, just get into a lot of trouble, I think there are times when we can give them opportunities to use some of those natural tools and dig into their natural repertoire a little bit more. There's nothing as fun as seeing a dog, you know, run full on, just be completely out there free. For those people who have an opportunity to do that, obviously we can't always, you know, just let them do that. But in the book, I talk about Odin at one point and just he's allowed to just run free on the beach and, you know, tongue hanging all the way to the sand, and he's filthy and he's, you know, got the spray of the water in his face. And it's just such a beautiful thing to see. But also just being more patient, I think, with letting them sniff when you're out on a walk and maybe letting them roll a little bit sometimes, you know, it's not the worst thing. And, you know, there are people that say we should think of them as partners rather than as our pets. I think that's a little unrealistic. I think we're always going to be in charge. We are the owners. But that gives us a chance to say, you know, my dog loves sniffing. What can I do to enhance that, to give them opportunities to do more of that? And if that means doing a sniffer class or just taking a longer walk and letting them make decisions, are we going to turn right or left? Let the dog decide, you know, giving them the sense of choice is supposed to make them more optimistic and happier.
We've been speaking with National Geographic writer Jennifer Holland. She's the author of a book that spent more than 46 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. That's Unlikely Friendships. And now she's back with a new book called Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's one of my favorite topics.
Oh, thank you. Mine too.